So, today I will talk about the preservation of ancient heterogeneity in the earth mantle. So, preservation in English, heterogeneity. Covering a lot of time scales here. The motivation for the talk is that basically we understand pretty well the composition of the upper mantle through inversion of the mid-ocean ridge basalt melting process, but we don't really know very well the composition of the lower mantle, therefore we don't have very good constraints on the bulk composition of the silicate earth. So this is like a long-standing issue, and of course it's connected to other large-scale questions, like, for example, what is the light element composition of the core? So you need to have some good constraints on the composition of the lower mantle to address these questions. So basically, we're interested in the recipe of this cake. So there is two n-member compositions of the lower mantle that have been put forward. So if the upper mantle is red and the lower mantle is green here, then the lower mantle could be just the same composition as the upper mantle, so something that we call spiralite, or it's similar to a rock type. Or the mantle might be more similar, at least in rock-forming elements, in terms of a chondrite composition. So this has important implications. For example, if we look at very major elements such as magnesium and silica, a pyrolite has a magnesium to silica ratio of about 1.3, and chondrites span quite a range of magnesium to silica ratios, but they plot around 1.0. So this is quite a difference. And if you think that the Earth is made of the chondritic building blocks of the solar system, then it's quite difficult to explain why the whole mantle should have a magnesium to silica ratio of 1.3. So the key geophysical observations that I will use, the key geophysical observations that I will use to address this issue is the stagnation of some slabs at 1,000 kilometers depth, and we've heard about this. Some slabs stagnate here, some slabs stagnate at the 660, other slabs sink deep into the mantle. And we kind of have to explain the coexistence of these three regimes, or at least of these two regimes here in terms of the lower mantle, of slab sinking behavior on the same planet at the same time. So it's not like all the slabs stagnate at 1,000 kilometers depth. Another issue that we use here as a constraint from geochemistry is the preservation of the 182 tungsten heterogeneity. We've also learned about this in the last 2 weeks. 182 tungsten is a radionuclide, or the parent. 182 hafnium is extinct after about 30 million years. So any heterogeneity that we see in the present-day mantle, so this is ocean island basalt, some negative tungsten anomalies. This is Buffin Bay, some large igneous provinces, Phanerozoic large igneous provinces with positive tungsten anomalies. So any of this heterogeneity which is preserved in the present-day mantle has to be very old, because, as I mentioned, the parent of this radionuclide is very short-lived. So somewhere in the Earth mantle there must be some heterogeneity. We don't know where or how it looks like. And it must be, we call this primordial heterogeneity. And this even predates the moon-forming giant impact. If the moon-forming giant impact happened at 50 million years after solar system formation, then this heterogeneity must have even survived the moon-forming, the very violent moon-forming giant impact. So the big question, of course, is if there are these primordial or primitive, I would like to call them more general primordial heterogeneity here for the purpose of this talk. Heterogeneities, if they exist somewhere in the Earth mantle, how are they distributed? Where are they? I guess we've seen this slide before, and yeah. So this is a big question, and I'd like to go into this a little bit more in this talk. But first of all, let me get out of the way how to create primordial heterogeneity in the first place. So if you go back to the magma ocean, for example, after the moon-forming giant impact, but there might be multiple stages of magma oceans, then you freeze this magma ocean, for example, from the bottom up in the simplest scenario. There are different scenarios for that. So you crystallize Yeah, Ridgmanite, MgSiO3. And then, of course, the magma ocean will tend to get more enriched in, or less enriched in silica and more enriched in iron. So it will actually move towards magnesium to silica ratios of 1.3, because you take out silica into this Bridgmanite, and eventually you also tend to enrich it in incompatible elements and in iron, which acts like an incompatible element. So this is a way to, so it's very straightforward to come up with initial stratification or large-scale heterogeneity in the early Earth. So now if we look earlier, I guess if we look at the process of core formation, and you build the planet from a bunch of planetesimals, so this could be the proto-Earth, then you have the moon forming giant impact, and you have the last stage of metal silicate. So here, metal silicate equilibration. And if this metal silicate equilibration does not equilibrate throughout the whole planet, then you will form some heterogeneity. So this is basically incomplete equilibration during core metal differentiation. And this is actually what we expect. So several papers are out there for moon forming giant impact. This is just a recent one that I've been involved with, where it shows that in the deep mantle, you can potentially preserve some proto-Earth characteristics. The proto-Earth mantle here in light blue, and the target mantle, spectral mantle here in red. So this is potentially another source of large-scale heterogeneity in the early Earth. But the big question is, of course, how can we sustain this heterogeneity? How can we preserve this heterogeneity over billions of years of mantle convection and mixing? It will basically go through two different scenarios, two different mechanisms, geodynamical mechanisms that can do this. So one I will call unmixing, and the other one has something to do with compositional rheology. And I will go into this a little bit later. And of course, this has to be tested with geophysical observations. And later on, I will go into more of these scenarios of the origin of heterogeneity. So we've just looked at two different scenarios, for example, the core formation or the magma ocean. So let's briefly talk about unmixing of mantle heterogeneity. So this is a global scale. Mantle convection model. So here in colors, there's Hartzburgite in blue, so a lithological end member, and basaltic material, mafic material in red, which is introduced into the mantle at these subduction zones. And then it is mixed and stirred. But it is quite efficiently mixed on one hand, but on the other hand, it's also kind of unmixed or segregated from each other, because both these lithologies are subject to different density profiles. So Hartzburgite in general is less dense than basalt. And except for this depth range between 660 and 7-something, where basalt is actually positively buoyant. So you expect basalt to accumulate a little bit in the transition zone, but eventually also, because there's subduction going on, that you see it here a little bit also in this movie, that kind of cleans out the transition zone where the basalt accumulates. Eventually, this basalt will sink to the lower mantle and form piles here in the lower mantle. This is what you expect from the density profile, as long as you can segregate these two lithologies from each other. So this is, of course, a requirement. This will depend on what you put into the models. So you need some region in the lower mantle, for example, or anywhere in the mantle where the viscosities are low enough such that you can segregate these two end-member lithologies from each other. In this particular model, you can obviously do this quite well, and you get an enrichment of basalt in the mantle transition zone, and also the upper mantle is generally depleted compared to the bulk mantle, lower mantle, I should say. So this is depth, this is just basic composition, basalt on this side and Hartzburgite on the other side. And then you have accumulation of basalt in the deep mantle, and so this model predicts accumulation of basalt in the deep mantle and in the mantle transition zone, but also some accumulation, even if you don't see it so much here, because the picture is basically very noisy, some enhancement of basalt in the lower mantle compared to the upper mantle. So you can get some large-scale heterogeneity even without, say, primordial heterogeneity, but just by unmixing of basalt from Hartzfeld bed. And if you're interested in more details, then you can also talk to Jun, who's running similar simulations like this right now. This is basically the model cake, but in this case, the bottom of the model cake would be here, more chocolatey than the top part of the model cake. But this doesn't really address the preservation of ancient primordial heterogeneity. So let's look at the effects of compositional rheology. So this is just a model where we have some ancient heterogeneity, but in this case, this is just two different colors, red and blue, so no large difference in material properties. And if we run this model, I have to fast forward a little bit. this is very fast forward. In the interest of time, you will get very good mixing and almost no preservation of these primordial heterogeneities after, say, 5 billion years or something like that. But now if you consider that, as I mentioned before, in this scenario of magma ocean crystallization, that the lower mantle might be mostly MgSiO3 with a magnesium to silica ratio of 1.0, and then as magma ocean crystallization progresses, you evolve towards this eutectic composition of, which is close to pyrolite, so you have an upper mantle that has more of a pyrolytic composition, with a magnesium to silica ratio of 1.3, then the rheology of these two compositions might be quite distinct from each other. So this lower mantle is basically chondritic or prichronitic, so mostly brichmanite, MgSiO3, just one type of mineral, and this is a very stiff mineral. I think this is also something we've learned in the last 2 weeks, so a very strong mineral. Whereas a ferropyroclase here in black is weak, so if you put pyrolytic material into the lower mantle, then this material will be relatively weak because ferropyroclase is weak. In particular, once you start deforming it and form this interconnected weak layers of ferropyroclase upon a low strain of 2 to 4, you will already form these interconnected weak layers. And then the rheology of the bulk rock will be dominated by that of ferropyroclase. And I will show that for a viscosity contrast of about 2 orders of magnitude, we will see a completely different behavior. I think this has been also shown last week, but these are unpublished results here in this spherical geometry. So now, after an initial overturn, we see that there is formation of upwelling and downwelling conduits, but between the upwelling and downwelling conduits, there is this strong material that can survive, and this remains largely unmixed.
Yeah, okay, just a quick point of information. You said in spherical geometry, is this an annulus or is this a full sphere?
It's an annulus, yeah. It's a spherical annulus. Yeah, we will move on to 3D hopefully in the future. Play this again a little bit. So most of the deformation is focused along these upwelling and downwelling conduits, and in the core of the convection cell, it's mostly there is little or no deformation. You can see here even that, the slabs, you can already see that some of these slabs are deflected by the presence of these guys, but of course this will depend also a little bit on the viscosity parameterization you put in there. Another thing that you can see if you look at the temperature field, you don't see much. So these big blobs or beams, as we call them, the brichmanite-enriched ancient mantle structures, are not very apparent in the temperature field, so also in tomography they would not be sticking out. They would not be expected to be sticking out.
They're compositionally distinct, though, right?
That's right, yeah.
So they would have the compositional signature, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. We computed that, and actually that's not very strong.
Could you quantify not very strong?
Well, you can.
Yeah, this is the slide that Christine showed, right? At least if you try to compare it, say, with PREM, then you see that the differences in VP, VS, and compressional wave speed are not very large between pure pyrolyte and beams, and particularly if you also account for the different.
And this is not pure Bridgemite material. This is a beams mantle, which is a mixture of perspergite and
Bridgemite. That's right. So yeah. But this is also certainly something we would like to do more explicitly and then compare with seismic tomography more rigorously.
One last question would be the distribution of heat sources. Is that uniform across the mantle in these calculations, or does it vary between the different?
In this calculation, there are no heat sources. Radioactive heating, internal heating within the beams might be actually a problem for their long-term stability. So they would have to be depleted, and we will come back to this later in the terms of the origin scenario. Just very quickly, this is what I skipped, that, it's just showing that you need, well, this is now from the published paper, so 1.5 to 2 orders of magnitude viscosity contrast to get this beams regime, and also a small density contrast of 0.5%, which is not very much. to get into this regime compared to the more well-mixed regime.
So is that consistent with what is modeled in a density contrast for the compositional changes?
Yeah, well, it depends on the origin scenario. So we just impose a density contrast and a viscosity contrast, and then in the end we think about whether there is a origin scenario that could be producing such a material.
But a pyrolytic versus a purely perovskitic mantle.
Well, it depends how much iron you put in there, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
So what this says here is if there's no density contrast, they float to the top, and if there's too much density, they sink to the bottom, so they just use.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you would extend this parameter study, which in the new calculations, the spherical calculations we do, but here in this public, this is from the Cartesian calculations we haven't done yet. So yeah, if you go further up, you get piles, basically.
Yeah. What is the viscosity contrast you're using?
In this one?
Yeah.
It's 100, yeah.
Can you show how you get your initial condition, how do you get to this to develop?
The initial condition is this.
It's just this, okay.
Yeah. As also Christine mentioned, PREM alone is not really gonna decide between these two models. So we have to look at some other constraints. This is maybe circumstantial evidence as well, because there have been other models put forward that can account for slab stagnation at 1,000. But this one can do it as well. Can also explain why some slabs stagnate there and others just go through. So if they just happen to encounter one of these downward encounters. Then plume deflection, so if you have a circular flow around these guys, then you would potentially deflect plumes in a depth range which is similar to where slabs stagnate. And 1,000 kilometers consistent with the spherical analyst calculations that you've seen before. The viscosity hill in the mid-mantle, so in this case the viscosity hill would be just due to the manifestation or presence of beams in the depth range of 1,000 to 1,500 or slightly deeper. Preservation of geochemical reservoirs, I will come back to this a little bit later, but also keep in mind that there is positive and also negative tungsten anomalies. In my opinion, the positive tungsten anomalies are potentially would fit in here. And of course, it would balance the silica budget, so a beams planet would have a lower magnesium to silica ratio because you put extra silicate into the beams. So yeah, but of course, we don't have a smoking gun yet, so this is an idea, and maybe there's some planet out there that has beams, but if the Earth has beams, it's unknown. These are recent results by Lauren and She looked at reflections, underside reflections of so SS precursors basically in the mid-mantle depth range. And you see reflections, for example, at the top of the LLSVGs here, coherent reflectors. There's some regions which are not very well mapped. But then also in this region where we don't really expect neither downwelling nor dominant upwelling flow or off of Brazil, there are these reflectors, which we also see here, very large scale, extensive reflectors, which could correspond to the top of the beams. But again, it needs to be confirmed. One very good test would be to look at the electrical conductivity, which is strongly dependent on the ferroperoxide fraction in the lower mantle. But unfortunately, we don't have any good constraints on the electrical conductivity in the lower mantle yet. So this is science fiction at this stage. But in the future, maybe this will be ever, we can use this to test this model. Yeah, a lot of questions were already, you already had a lot of questions, and I already always referred you to the origin scenario. So at the moment, my favorite origin scenario, if it turns out that these beams really exist in the mantle, is a basal magma ocean cumulate. So if you have a basal magma ocean, so probably you know this theory where the mantle freezes from the middle and you have the shallow magma ocean and the basal magma ocean. So if you have a basal magma ocean, maybe these cumulates turn into the beams. And let me precise this a little bit more. So there are different scenarios for making a basal magma ocean. You can just have a density crossover here, and then if you have fractional crystallization, your basal magma ocean in the end will be moderately enriched in iron. If you have batch crystallization with compaction, then your basal magma ocean will be actually quite enriched in iron, because you're talking about the equilibrium between crystals and melt at higher crystal fractions, and this turns out to be important to whether this is a good candidate origin scenario for the beams. Now there is also another way of forming a basal magma ocean. So now here, actually, the color scale is a bit weird. Now here, the magma ocean is in gray, and the cumulates are here in the rainbow colors, colored by iron number. This is actually iron number going from 0 to 1. So this is iron rich, and this is iron poor. I'm not patient enough. So if we play this, so as I mentioned before in the cartoon, the cumulates get more and more iron enriched, and you get a big overturn, or here in this case, multiple incremental overturns. The iron rich stuff will sink to the bottom and remelt, and you get an iron rich magma ocean. So why am I talking about these? So this is in cartoon form, you get an overturn, and again an iron rich magma ocean, or basal magma ocean. So why do I prefer basal magma ocean cumulates as an origin scenario? Well, the magnesium to silica ratio of cumulates is 1 because it's basically griefenite. It's intrinsically strong. It would be slightly iron enriched, in particular in these two cases here. And it would be also depleted in incompatible elements. So no internal heating. This is the Bruce's question earlier. Because we're talking about, cumulates basically. And then possibly a geochemistry like FOSO, which is depleted also in strontium, neodymium.
I'm a little bit confused about the geochemical last slide.
Yeah.
So why is iron slightly enriched but is depleted in incompatible elements?
Well, the basal magma ocean would be iron-enriched and also enriched in incompatible elements, but the first cumulates from the basal magma ocean would be still very depleted, because the first column is because these elements are highly incompatible.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you mean like the fraction of melt is high, so.
Yeah. Exactly. But many of you have heard about the basal magma ocean cumulates in terms of the LSVP. So I just want to make the point that the late stage basal magma oceans, the more iron enriched cumulates, they might still be available to make the LLSVPs. So you can have the early BMO cumulates that would form the bezel, the beams, and the late stage BMO cumulates that form the LLSVPs at the same time. So these two reservoirs are not mutually exclusive.
So are you saying that the early BMO cumulates are iron enriched, or?
Like they're slightly, very slightly iron-enriched if you start from a, or they not, don't necessarily have to be enriched, but at least they're not depleted in iron compared to pyrolite, depending on what the composition of the basal magma ocean is from which you start. And that depends on scenarios. I mean, we've seen several scenarios for that. And then the late-stage basal magma ocean cumulates would be highly enriched in iron, and or more enriched in iron, and also enriched possibly in incompatible elements.
So if you say late BMO cumulates, you mean that they only gradually form during Earth history? So they're not directly there since the basal magma?
Yeah, you would, the basal magma ocean would freeze by a fractional crystallization. So the late stage, I mean the last, I don't know how many percent, but the last 50% maybe of this crystallization sequence. The very earliest BMO cumulates might actually also be lost. I mean, or some intermediate cumulates might be lost to mixing. This is something that would have to be modeled explicitly. There was another question, Zach?
Yeah, I guess I'm still, I think other people are asking this question as well, but I'm still not understanding how the where and how much iron there is, because your models that produce the beams were favored when you had a higher density in the beam yeah. regions, which you could get from stuffing more iron in there.
Yeah.
If you have more iron in there, then won't it behave like ferrocyclase, and then it's not a beam? I don't. What did I miss there?
Well, so I don't think you need a lot of more iron, right? Just a little bit, and. So as far as I understand, you can also put iron into bridgman, right? So bridgmanite is a solid solution between FeSiO3 and MgSiO3. So basically, we're talking about something that is maybe Mg0.9, Fe0.1, SiO3, which would have a very similar magnesium number as a pyrolite, but at least it's not buoyant, which would be a problem for beam stability, if they exist. So, I mean, if we turn out to find these gas, then we can actually make, I guess that's the purpose of this part of the talk, we can actually make pretty tight constraints on some earlier processes. If we don't find them, then, you know, they're not there, and all this exercise is not very real. Yeah. Okay, just maybe a final slide. A final interesting thought. So if you think about this magma ocean that is, for example, basal magma ocean that is stabilized, for example, due to an overturn, then you might also think that there might be another magma ocean episode before the giant impact. So maybe there was already a basal magma ocean, an iron-rich basal magma ocean, before the moon-forming giant impact there. That was iron-enriched and therefore could also survive during the moon-forming giant impact. So this would have been stably stratified, I guess. At some point over time, these two basal magma ocean would have been solidified and be sampled. Maybe there would be some beams, maybe not. At least there would have been samples sampled by plumes in the Archean, and then later on maybe by plumes from the edges. Of these LLSVPs, at least I think if the beams exist, they might potentially be a good reservoir to host a high 182 tungsten anomaly, and then the low 182 tungsten anomaly would be buried deep within the LLSVPs. Of course, in a very dense layer, we can also stabilize primordial material for a very long time. So As a conclusion, basically, I just want to go back to these two mechanisms to sustain large-scale heterogeneity in the Earth mantle. So there's unmixing or segregation of any small-scale heterogeneity, but at least we know that there is basalt and Hertzbergite somewhere in the mantle. And then maybe there are these beams due to the, which are stabilized by intrinsic high viscosity. But again, these two are not mutually exclusive. So you can think about a mantle where you have LLSVPs, where you have beams, where you have the lower mantle with a higher basalt content than the upper mantle due to some filtering, basically, across the mantle transition zone of basalt and Hertzbergite. And this is, in my opinion, a potential scenario for the Earth composition. Maybe it can resolve some of the missing reservoirs and whatnot. Okay, thanks for your attention. So I don't know in which order.
In terms of students,
just a quick question. What is the volume percent of these in the mantle band? Or even the mass percent as well, you know, iron.
Yeah, it could be just about 15%. So in the end, it wouldn't push you to a magnesium to silica ratio of 1.0, for example. But it would just help a little bit. In the end, also the nucleosynthetic isotopes suggest that the Earth is some kind of an ant member compared to the other planets. So, yeah. But it would help a little bit to get closer to lower magnesium to silica ratios.
So, when you compare the seismic velocity to like prime model, what is the VC mean?
VC is the compressional wave speed, so I think this was...
VC is the bulk sound speed.
Yeah.
That's the compressional, it's the bulk sound.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah. This was very well explained by a guy.
But I noticed that there is also like discrepancy between VC and prime model about 80 GPA to 100 GPA.
That's because Renata's calculations include the spin transition in ferropericlase. That's where that difference comes from.
Yeah, I can go back, but you can ask more questions in the meantime. Max?
Looking at this plot, I was wondering how large are the variations at a given pressure between the background mantle and the beams in percent?
We calculate this, I believe it's in the supplementary information, because we compare, this was about the slabs disappearing, so because a more perovskitic material has a slightly higher velocity, that the seismic difference between a cold Hertzbergite and a perovskite decrease in the mid-mantle versus a pyrolite.
So, I mean, like the plateau on the upper left,
yeah.
That's a very nice plateau. But here you have the RSVP, which is something you call the later EMO or whatever. But I see for me, your model, you only model one, you only model the beam, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Model that models both.
Yeah, I think we want to also do that. Yeah, we want to model both where we would basically have an initial condition with a late stage cumulus and an early stage cumulus, or with a more realistic cumulus sequence after magma ocean formation. So this is on the to-do list for the student that is working on.
I think it's doable.
Yeah, it seems doable. One word about the LLSVPs is that if you have the beams, so if they are really there, then this also poses different boundary conditions on the LLSVP. So, I mean, in recent models, you always need a delicate balance, actually, between the buoyancy of the LLSVPs and mantle flow to make these piles. Then if you go back in time, then you actually get problems. You get into problems. But here, in this case, the LLSVPs could be denser, but they could be just piled up due to more focused flow around these beams, and also the shape of the LLSVPs, the slope and so on, could be potentially constrained by just the shape of these strong beams. Yeah. But
I have two questions. One is, I don't quite follow. So in the first part of the talk, you showed that you would expect to have accumulation of basalt, and that this accumulation of basalt explains the LSVPs. But then in the later part of the talk, you talked about this late magma ocean cumulus.
Yeah, I guess in the first part of the talk, this is more based on the work that I published in 2015, that the null hypothesis, basically, heterogeneity in the mantle is what we know about, what we can really touch, the heterogeneity that is injected into the mantle at the subduction zones. But of course, any dense material will accumulate at the mantle.
So where would the basalt from that model go in a model like this?
There are models. I mean, Mingming had some models like this, Takashi as well. If you have basalt and dense primordial material, then you would have usually, if the dense primordial material is denser than the basalt, then you would have a double layered LLSV. It's like an
because if you go back and show the, it seems like a lot of basalt. It's like half the mantle is full of basalt.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's assuming 4.5 billion years of basalt.
Oh, okay.
And that also depends on the density profiles you put in there. I mean, maybe didn't show the. There is some uncertainty in terms of the delta rho of basalt at the base of the mantle. And if you play with that uncertainty, you can get a more realistic. Okay.
So you would have to have thicker crust and higher efficiency of recycling to get that much crust in mantle over 4.5 billion years.
Yeah.
Which is possible.
Okay, so then my other question is, can you show the movie that made this?
Yeah.
It was like a little bit earlier. That why is the whole mantle rotating?
Yeah, this is just a visualization issue, yeah.
It looks like a washing machine. So it's not actually rotating.
Well, there are plates. There are plates, and the plates are subducting here. There's only in this planet. There's only one subduction zone. But if you vary the plate yield stress, then you can get more plates.
Because it seems like the rotation is what's laying down the.
Oh yeah, this is misleading. This could be just taken out. I mean, this is. I mean, Takashi made this movie, but this is something you can take out from the models.
It looks like only the mantle is rotating, so the subduction zone itself looks like it's.
Just change your reference
frame. Maybe. You know more about
pushing the whole mantle.
I think we can take this out.
So it's a matter of reference frame.
Yeah, it's a reference frame.
It's a reference frame.
Okay, Max, I think that was great. Thanks very much.